Chapter 42. Reacher squatted by the horizontal figure. Chang knelt beside him. The guy was on his back, his legs splayed, his arms in disarray. He was unconscious, or deep in shock, or in a coma, or all of the above. His neck was a mess. Half of it was missing. He smelled of dirty clothes and sweat and the iron stink of blood. He smelled of death. But there was faint respiration and a thready pulse. "How is that even possible?" Reacher whispered. A piece the size of a porterhouse steak came flying out of him.
"Obviously not a vital piece," Chang whispered back.
"What do you want to do?"
"I don't know. We can't call the ambulance. They'll bring the cops with them. They always do for gunshot victims. We wouldn't get a head start. But on the other hand, this guy looks pretty bad. He needs a trauma surgeon as soon as possible."
"Evan is a doctor."
"But what kind? He'd take one look and call the ambulance himself, immediately. And then he'd call the cops himself, also immediately. He's shaky on the 30-minute thing anyway."
"We could walk out and leave the guy here."
"Who would know? Too hard on Evan, potentially. This guy might live 30 minutes. Then the story would leak. He'd be the doctor who ignored a dying man so he could go sit in his bedroom."
Reacher put his fingertips high on the guy's neck, on the intact portion above the wound, one on each side, behind the ears, near the hinges of the jaw. He kept them there. Chang said,
"What are you doing?"
"Compressing the arteries that feed his brain."
"You can't do that."
"What? It was okay to murder him the first time, but not the second time?"
It's wrong."
"It was right the first time, when he was a piece of shit who was about to rape you at gunpoint. Did he change? Did he suddenly become some kind of a saintly martyr we should rush straight to the hospital?
When did that part happen?" "How long will this take?"
"Not long. He wasn't well to begin with."
"This is so wrong."
"We're doing him a favor. Like a horse with a broken leg. No one could fix this neck." Her phone rang, loud and clear, penetrating. She juggled it out and hunched away and answered it. She listened. She whispered. She clicked off. Reacher said, "Who was that?"
"Westwood has landed at Sky Harbor."
"Good to know."
"I said we'd call him back."
"Probably best."
"The family will have heard the phone. They'll know we're still here."
"They'll think it's one of these guys, in a pocket. They'll ignore it."
"Is that guy dead yet?"
"Nearly there. It's peaceful, like falling asleep."
Then he sat back and checked for a pulse and didn't find one. He said, "Let's go." Their car was on the curb 100 yards away in what had been the closest spot when they arrived. Then the tide had gone out and left it high and dry. It was all alone. Chang drove. She U-turned across the road and headed back the way they had come. The development was quiet. Stunned by heat, the air shimmered everywhere, blue and gold, like liquid. The gatehouse had both barriers up. Both red-striped poles were vertical, like a fat bird dressed for the oven. Wide open, both ways, in and out, no guard behind the glass. Chang stopped the car. She said,
"Check it out."
The blacktop was hot under Reacher's feet. He could have fried an egg on it. He heard the buzz of flies 6 feet away. The sliding window was open, where the guard leaned out to talk.
"I hope you folks have a wonderful afternoon."
The AC was running hard, trying to cope. The guard was on the floor, all tangled up around the legs of his stool. Short-sleeved shirt, mottled arms, open eyes. He had been shot once in the chest and once in the head. Flies were feasting on his blood, blue and iridescent, crawling, already laying eggs. Reacher walked back to the car. He said,
"The old guy, not going to get any older."
"Makes me feel better about the assisted homicide."
"Makes me wish I had found a butter knife in the kitchen and cut his head off."
Chang drove out the gate and took random lefts and rights. They heard no howling sirens in the distance, no commotion, just the perpetual Phoenix traffic, three shiny lanes like a slow river, rolling along forever.
"Where to?"
she said.
"Let's go find a cup of coffee, and there's a call you need to make."
They pulled in at a strip mall in Paradise Valley. There was a big-name coffee shop sandwiched between a store selling leather belts with silver buckles and a store selling china plates with fancy patterns. Chang got iced coffee and Reacher got hot. They sat at a sticky table in back. Reacher said, "Tell Westwood to pick a hotel, somewhere convenient to suit his budget. Tell him we'll join him there in 2 hours."
"Why 2 hours?"
"Do you guys have a Phoenix office?"
"Of course. Lots of retired FBI in Phoenix."
"We need local knowledge."
"About the guys at the house?"
"About their boss, who was also Hackett's boss, a provider of outsourced security for what is no doubt a varied roster of clients. The service economy at work. Physically, he sounded like a big guy to me, on the phone. And then the guy who did all the talking at the house called him the fat man. Did you hear that? He was moaning about not getting paid and not being able to renegotiate afterward. And he said those are the fat man's rules. So we need a name. An Eastern European Phoenix area crime boss who runs Eastern European muscle locally and people like Hackett elsewhere, and who could plausibly be called fat. Behind his back, presumably. Known locations would be good, too."
"Why?"
"I want to pay him a visit."
"Why?"
"For Emily. And for McCann's sister, and the guard in the gatehouse. And my back hurts, and I have a headache now. Some things can't be allowed to continue."
Chang nodded.
"And some things have side benefits."
"Exactly."
"Mother's Rest will be left wide open. We'll be canceling its security contract by cutting off its head before we go back there."
"Is that the kind of information your local person would have?"
"I would, if someone called me about Seattle."
She took out her phone and dialed, first Westwood about the hotel, and then she scrolled through her contacts and found her local number. A spare bedroom, presumably, close by, in Mesa or Glendale or Sun City. Fitted out with matching shelves and cabinets and a desk and a chest of drawers and a computer and a telephone and a fax machine and a printer. Investments for a new career. We have offices everywhere. Reacher got up and headed for the men's room, where he checked himself in the mirror for blood, whether his or not, or other signs of mayhem. Always prudent. Once he arrested a guy who had his victim's tooth stuck in his hair, front and center, like a pale yellow bead from a salon near the beach. Then he washed his hands very thoroughly, and his wrists and his forearms with plenty of soap, to get rid of the gunshot residue. Also, always prudent. Why make it easy? Back at the table, Chang said,
"He's Ukrainian, and his name is Merchenko."
Reacher said, "Is he fat?"
"Apparently he's colossal."
"Do we know where he does business?"
"He has a private club south of the airport."
Security?
We don't know.
Can we get in the club?
Members only.
We could apply for jobs. I could be a bouncer.
What could I be?
Depends what kind of club it is.
I think we can guess.
Works for me aesthetically, Reacher said. We should go look at the place, right now. Better to see it in the daylight. South of the airport was not all Badlands, but it was brighter and brasher than what they saw on the way. Merchenko's club was a metal building about the size of Yankee Stadium, but square. It filled its own block, sidewalk to sidewalk. The walls were painted pink and softened in shape by hundreds of giant foil balloons, also pink, some in the shape of hearts and some in the shape of lips, all of them somehow fixed to the siding. Lacing in and out between them were miles of neon, right then bleached gray by the sun, but at night, no doubt, pink. What other color would the neon be? The door was pink, and it had a pink plastic awning above it, and the name of the place was Pink. Chang said,
"Should we risk going around the block?"
"It's early," Reacher said. "Should be safe enough." So she turned left off the frontage and drove down the right-hand side. Same huge size, same pink, same lips and hearts, which were kind of drunk-friendly, Reacher thought, better than swaying the other way into traffic. Then they saw the building did not fill the whole block, side to side maybe, but not front to back. It stopped short, and the rear part of the block was a delivery yard, which made sense. A club that size would need all kinds of consumables, like an ocean liner, and it would generate all kinds of trash and recycling, which would need regular pickup. The yard was fenced with some kind of superior hurricane wire, interwoven with pink screens so it wasn't see-through. The fence was topped with floppy rolls of razor wire to keep climbers out, but 2 10-foot lengths were hinged to fold inward, which made sense because of the truck traffic in and out, food and drink and garbage. One of those gates was open. "Stop," Reacher said. Chang did, and then backed up discreetly for a better view. She said,
"I don't believe it."
Inside the gate was a line of head-high trash containers, and then next came an area outside the kitchen door with fake green grass laid on the concrete and a token picket fence and a white metal garden bench and a big canvas sun umbrella for chefs and waiters to smoke in comfort. Sitting on the bench was a fat man. He was smoking a thick cigar and talking to a Hispanic guy who was wearing a wife beater and a do-rag and standing rigidly to attention, his gaze fixed on a spot in the air just above the fat man's head. But fat was too small a word, and plainly inadequate for the occasion. The man on the bench was not plump or big-boned or overweight or even obese. He was a mountain. He was huge, over 6 feet, and that was side to side. He dwarfed the bench. He was wearing an ankle-length caftan, gray in color, and his knees were forced wide by his belly, and he was leaning back, perched with his ass on the very front part of the seat, because in the other direction his belly wouldn't let him fold up 90 degrees to a normal sitting position. There were no recognizable contours to his body. He was an undifferentiated triangle of flesh, with breasts the size of soft basketballs, and other unexplained lumps and bulges the size of king-size pillows. His arms were resting along the back of the bench, and huge dewlaps of fat hung down either side of dimpled elbows. All in all, he was colossal, which was the word Chang's contact had used. His head was tiny in comparison with his body. His face was pink and shiny from the sun, and his eyes were small and deep-set, partly because he was squinting against the light, and partly because his face was swollen tight, as if someone had stuck a bicycle pump in his ear and given it 10 long strokes. His haircut was the same scalped style as the three guys at McCann's sister's house. Chang said,
"He could be a brother or a cousin. Maybe it's a fat family."
"He looks like the boss," Reacher said. "Look how he's talking to that guy. He's giving him a real hard time." And he was. No histrionics, no shouting, just a steady stream of words, unending, conversational, and therefore probably all the more cruel and effective. The guy in the do-rag wasn't enjoying himself. That was for damn sure. He was holding himself rigid, staring at the air, riding it out. Chang said,
"We have to be sure. Maybe Merchenko delegates. Maybe there are underbosses. Maybe this is a brother or a cousin taking care of staff relations for him."
Reacher said, "Did your contact mention family members?"
"She didn't say."
"Can you check?" Chang dialed her phone. Reacher watched the fat man. He wasn't going anywhere. Not yet. He was still talking. Chang asked her question and listened to the answer. She hung up the phone. She said,
"We don't know of any family members."
"He looks like the boss," Reacher said again. "Except there's no security. No guys with sunglasses and wires in their ears. There would be one at the gate, surely. Bare minimum. This guy is supposed to be a crime boss. He's in full view of the street. We're just sitting here. No one has tried to chase us away."
"Confidence, maybe," Chang said. "Or overconfidence. He thinks we're dead by now. Maybe he's got nothing else to worry about. He could be the apex predator here, unchallenged.
If he's the guy."
"We shouldn't assume."
"I wish we could. I could hit him from here."
"Really?"
"Figure of speech. Not with a handgun. To be certain, I'd want to be closer."
"Inside the yard?"
"Ideally."
"Maybe there are guards behind the gate."
"Could be. But it's an image thing with these guys. They like to be seen behind a human wall. Or not seen."
"So maybe he's not the guy."
"He sure looks like the guy. He looks like a fat man, and it looks like he's making rules."
"We have to be certain."
"We'll never be certain. Unless I ask for ID, which he might not have. I don't see a pocket in his dress."
"It's a caftan or a muumuu."
"What's a muumuu?"
"What he's wearing."
"We need to know. This could be solid gold. He's right there."
"Which is the problem? It's too good to be true."
"Could be confidence, like he said. Could be pure routine. Maybe his security is inside. Maybe they're used to him ducking outside for a smoke. It's early, and they know no one's around. Maybe he doesn't like them close. Or maybe he thinks staff relations are best done in private."
"How long will he stay there?"
"It's a big cigar, but maybe he smokes it a bit at a time."
"We'll never have a better chance."
"And it can't last much longer."
"But we have to know."
Reacher said nothing. The fat man kept on talking, maybe getting more intense. He was jabbing his head with every beat. The fat on his neck was jiggling. The rest of his body was implacably still, not made for gesture. Reacher said, "I think he's summing up. I think he's arriving at a conclusion. We don't have much more time. We need a decision." Chang said nothing. Then she said,
"Wait."
She raised her phone, and Reacher saw a picture swim on the screen. The sidewalk, the pink fence, the open gap. An odd angle, unsteady. Camera mode. then the trash containers, the fake garden, and the fat man. She touched the screen, and the phone made a sound like a shutter. Then she swiped and dabbed and typed and dabbed again, and the phone made a sound like a whoosh. She said,
"I'm asking my contact for visual ID."
Reacher said, "She better hurry. This can't last much longer." The fat man kept on talking and jabbing and jiggling. The guy in the do-rag kept on taking it. Then the fat man's fingers started scrabbling at the top slat of the bench, possibly the beginning of a long and complicated procedure designed to get himself up. Reacher said, "We're losing him." The fat man threw his cigar on the ground. Chang's phone dinged. She checked the screen. She said,
"Oh, come on."
"What?"
"She wants me to zoom in. She wants a close-up."
"What is this, the Supreme Court?" She raised her phone again and did something with her fingers, like the opposite of a pinch, and she got the fat man as big as she could and steadied him in the center of the frame and clicked the picture. Reacher turned around to get the Ruger off the floor and back, just in case. He heard the whoosh of her text or her email or whatever it was. He kept the gun low and smuggled it between the seats to his lap. A solid weapon, nothing fancy. The firearm equivalent of a domestic sedan, like the rental Chevrolet they were sitting in. The suppressor was an aftermarket item, with a custom mount. The magazine was two rounds short, from the old guy in the booth, the chest and the head. "I hope you folks have a wonderful afternoon." Reacher waited. Then the fat man levered his hips forward, a special technique, clearly. He was going to jack himself straight like a plank and then walk himself upright with his hands, or push off from behind and hope to totter away. Neither maneuver easy, but one or the other obviously possible. The guy hadn't spent his whole life in the same spot. Reacher said, "We're out of time." But then the Hispanic guy spoke. Maybe a heartfelt statement, full of apology and contrition, full of promises of future reform, and likely polite and certainly short. But apparently there was something in it the fat man wanted to either rebut or comment on further, because he settled back down amid much asynchronous wobbling and shaking, and he started talking again. Chang's phone dinged. She checked the screen. She said,
"We're 100% sure that's Merchenko."
Chapter 43. She drove 20 yards down the street, and then she U-turned, sidewalk to sidewalk, and came back slow, easing to a stop on the curb just shy of the first possible line of sight out the open half of the gate, which put Reacher about 60 feet from the target, 20 to the gate and 40 in the yard, a right-hand turn. He opened his door and climbed out. There was no easy way to hide a silenced pistol, so he carried it down by his leg, long and threatening, mid-thigh to mid-calf, completely unambiguous. But the acoustic benefits would be worth it, he hoped, during business hours, close to the center of America's sixth largest city. 6 paces on the sidewalk, and then he turned in at the yard. No guards behind the gate. The trash containers dead ahead, then the garden, then the fat man. Still talking, not looking, not yet. The Hispanic guy still standing, chin up, eyes level, still taking it. Reacher kept walking, brisk but not urgent, the gun still down, his heels loud on the concrete, so loud it was impossible the fat man wasn't already staring at him. But he wasn't. He was still talking, audible now, the same flat tones from the telephone, scolding, belittling, humiliating, his head jerking above the vast wattle of his neck. Then he was staring. He turned his head, completely independent of his immobile body, and his mouth came open, and Reacher stepped over the token foot-high picket fence to the shiny grass, and he raised the gun and he took one step more. In the tall tales told by firelight, there was always a brief and laconic conversation, because the bad guy had to be told why he had to die, as if reference to injured parties like Emily Lair and Peter and Lydia McCann and the gate guard's grandchildren could conjure up spirits and console them, and also because the bad guy had to be given the chance to either repent or snarl further defiance, either of which could turn a story classic, depending on the hero's next reply. But tales were tales, and not the real world. Reacher said nothing, and shot the fat man in the head, twice, a double tap, pop, pop, and then he watched the kitchen door, which stayed shut. The suppressor worked pretty well out in the open air. Reacher turned back and stepped over the foot-high fence. Behind him, the Hispanic guy said,
"Gracias, hombre."
Reacher smiled. Pretty much manna from heaven for that guy. Pretty much exactly what he was praying for every minute. To the letter. His exact words. "Dear Lord, please send someone to shoot this bastard in the head right now." A miracle. He would go to Mass on Sunday. Reacher walked away through the yard, the same route, the same speed, brisk but not urgent. He wiped the gun as he went on his shirt and dumped it in the first trash container he came to. Then he continued out through the gate, and as soon as Chang saw him, she eased the car forward and he climbed in, and she drove away. Westwood had chosen a fancy place out by Scottsdale, and traffic was slow because of the afternoon rush hour, so it was getting dark when they arrived. They found the guy in the bar, looking just the same with his tousled hair and his tangled beard, in his papery clothes full of zippers, with his enormous satchel at his feet. He was reading a book about marijuana, maybe his next subject after wheat. Chang settled in to give him the so-far play-by-play, and Reacher went to wash more gunshot residue off his hands. When he got back, Westwood asked him, "Do you believe journalists have ethics?" Reacher said, "I'm sure it varies." "You better hope I'm one who doesn't, because a reasonable interpretation of what Ms. Chang just told me is you committed 4 homicides today." "One of them twice," Reacher said. "Not funny." "Feel free to go home whenever you want. They're your book rights, not mine. Someone else can pick over the story after it happens." "Is there a story?" "There are only 3 parts we're not sure about."
"Which are?"
"The beginning, the middle, and the end."
Westwood was quiet for a long moment, then he said, "I heard the name Merchenko before, back when I was working on the Deep Web piece. Allegedly, he offered a menu of services. He would guarantee invisibility for your website, and he would handle problems if they arose. It was like a subscription thing. The Ukrainians were into online stuff early. I didn't write about him in the paper because nothing was proved. Legal wouldn't let me."
"How many clients did Merchenko have?"
"People said 10, or thereabouts. Kind of boutique."
"That guy wasn't boutique. He wouldn't know boutique if it ran up and bit him on his fat ankle. He had a strip club bigger than Dodger Stadium. It was pink and covered in balloons. He liked excess. He liked volume."
10 is what I heard."
"Then the volume must have come from revenue. Those 10 clients must have been earning a fortune."
"Possible," Westwood said. "The deep web could be 500 times bigger than the surface web. Very little of it makes money, I imagine, but very little of it needs to.
in a universe that large, to earn a fortune overall, I mean. Chang said,
Has the government built a search engine capable of seeing the deep web?
Westwood said, No.
That was what McCann was calling about.
Then he was asking the wrong question. Or the right question, the wrong way. I start to tune out when a caller talks about the government. Like a litmus test for common sense. I mean, who builds search engines? Software writers, that's who. Coders. A tough project needs the best coders, and the best coders are rock stars now. They have agents and managers. They get paid a lot of money. The government can't afford them. The alternative is kids, rock stars still in their hungry years. But the government doesn't hire them either. Too far outside, it's playbook. Those kids are weird.
What would have been the right question, the right way?
He should have looked at Silicon Valley, not the government.
Has someone in Silicon Valley built a search engine capable of seeing the deep web?
Westwood said, No.
McCann felt there was a hint in your piece.
I asked what the motivation would be for one of the big guys like Google, which is not obvious. It would help law enforcement, but there's no money to be made, by definition. If deep web people wanted advertising and promotion, they could come up to the surface web and grab it right now. The point is, they actively don't want it. They're actively declining to become customers, and they always will. A better search engine will drive them deeper down, that's all. It will turn into an arms race with no money to be made, ever.
Why would anyone do that?
McCann called you 18 times. The hint must have been positive.
I said someone else would do it. He must have thought I meant the government. But I didn't. The big guys like Google weren't always big. Once they were two kids in a garage or a dorm room. Some of them set out to be billionaires from the get-go, but some of them didn't. Some of them just got caught up in solving an interesting problem, which happened to be worth billions later. It's a personality thing. It's about the solving, not the problem. It's a compulsion. Who knows where it will strike?
Are you saying some kid in a dorm room has built a search engine that can see the deep web?
Not exactly, Westwood said. Not a kid. Not a dorm room, and not exactly built. Like I told you, it's a compulsion. They can't explain it. But sooner or later, a problem speaks to them, and they have to solve it. They won't be beat. But 9 times out of 10, there's no commercial application. So they get a day job, and it becomes a hobby. But they keep coming back to it every now and then. They keep tinkering. It will never be finished because of time and money, but that's not a problem for a hobby. In fact, that's the point of a hobby.
Chang asked, Who?
He's a startup guy in Palo Alto, already a veteran figure, 29 years old, currently doing well with retail payment systems. But as an undergrad, someone told him he couldn't search the deep web. And that was all she wrote. It was like a red rag to a bull, some weird intellectual spark. No money in it, he knew. Always a hobby. He admits it was mostly arrogance. Some geeks are like that. They need to be better than the other geek.
How far along is he now?
That's an impossible question. How could he know? He can see some of it, clear as day, but is that all of it, or only a tiny part?
I don't understand why you didn't say more in your piece. This is a big part of the story, right? Progress has been made?
The guy wouldn't let me. He was scared of retaliation from the deep web people. Some of those sites really don't want to be found. He was the guy who told me about Merchenko. A hobby project makes him an easy target. He's not a team, he's just one guy. And he was right to be scared, according to you. I wasn't sure at the time. It could have been drama. They're in a world of their own. Reacher said, we need to meet this guy.
Not easy.
Right now all we have is second-hand hearsay. But the consensus seems to be that Michael McCann used the deep web. And Michael McCann got off a train in a place called Mother's Rest. We need to know if one thing led to the other. Did he get off the train because of the Internet? Or was he going to get off anyway?
You think Mother's Rest is luring people in through the deep web?
We saw two people arrive by train. They spent a night in the motel and were driven away the next morning in a white Cadillac. Chang said,
they don't even have cell service. They can't be an Internet powerhouse, surely.
Westwood paused a beat, and then he said,
we should go somewhere more private.
20 miles south of Mother's Rest, the man with the ironed jeans and the blow-dried hair was pacing, waiting for his phone to ring, trying not to jump the gun. The last time he called ahead of schedule, he had been made to feel small. Let us do what we're good at, okay? Not that they had been. Not yet. Couldn't wait. He picked up the phone. He dialed. He got no answer. Westwood had called ahead with the reservations, not knowing, so he had gotten Reacher and Chang a room each. On realizing his mistake, he was neither embarrassed nor worried about the overspend. He simply chose the room with the stronger Wi-Fi and called it an office. He pulled his metal computer out of his bag and set it up on a desk. Reacher and Chang sat on the bed. Westwood said,
you mentioned Mother's Rest before, way back at the beginning, and you were right. A smart science editor would try to get a jump. So I did.
It's a grain loading station and a trading post. There's some technical stuff in the record, but a good reporter likes two sources. So I checked Google Earth, and sure enough, it's right there on the satellite pictures, right where it should be. And it looks exactly like a grain loading station and a trading post, but it's in the middle of absolutely nowhere. It's like L.A. County had one crossroads and the rest of it was empty. It was fascinating. So I messed around a little. I zoomed out to check how far it was from anywhere else, just for the fun of it, and I happened to see a neighbor about 20 miles south. The only neighbor, even more isolated. So naturally I zoomed in to take a look. He turned his computer to face the bed. He said,
and this is what I saw.
What he saw was bright daylight, of course, even though it was dark outside. Satellite photographs were not live, or up to date, necessarily. Things can change, or not. Reacher guessed the things on the screen hadn't changed in years. He was seeing a farm surrounded by a sea of wheat. The farm had a dwelling and a bunch of outbuildings. As far as could be told from a vertical, straight-down, harshly shadowed view, everything looked solid and squared away. The place was more or less self-sufficient. There were hogs and chickens and vegetable gardens. There was what looked like a generator building for electricity. The house itself looked sturdy. It had a place to park cars at one end and four satellite dishes at the other, and what looked like a well and a phone line. Westwood said, I remembered the satellite dishes later. What are they for?
Reacher said, TV.
Two of them are. The other two are looking at different birds.
Foreign TV.
Or satellite internet, maybe. All the bandwidth they want to pay for. Very fast. Doubled up for safety. with their own electricity. That would be an internet powerhouse right there. Can we tell by the way the dishes are set? We'd need to know what day and time Google clicked the picture to work out the angle of the shadows. Then we need to look from the inside. We need the search engine. If they're posting from there, we need to read what they're saying.
All I can do is ask.
Tell him Merchenko is dead. Tell him you had him whacked as a service to software developers everywhere. Tell him he owes you a favor.
Westwood said nothing. Reacher turned back to the screen. He said,
"Where is this place?"
"Exactly."
Westwood said, 20 miles south of Mother's Rest." And he leaned around from behind and pinched and swiped, making the farm smaller and the wheat bigger, no doubt intending to continue until Mother's Rest itself slid into view above, to show the distant geographic relationship. But before that happened, the picture was clipped across the bottom corner by a dead straight line, and Reacher said, "What's that?" Westwood said, "The railroad track. Show me." So Westwood came around from behind the screen and set it up properly. The farm and the railroad centered in their correct proportions, maybe 3/4 of a mile apart. The middle distance for most human eyes. Reacher said, "I remember that farm from when I arrived. It was the first human habitation the train passed in hours, 20 miles before it finally got to Mother's Rest. They were running a machine with lights, a tractor, maybe, at midnight."
"Is that normal?"
"I have no idea."
Chang said,
"We figured the Cadillac drove 20 miles. Remember that? 20 miles there and 20 miles back? Now we know where it was going. There's nowhere else it could go, 20 miles from Mother's Rest. So that's where the folks from the train went, the man and the woman, with their bags. But then where?"
No one answered. Westwood said,
"Do farmers use the deep web?"
"Someone does," Reacher said. "We need the search engine."
"The guy gets paid for his time."
"No one likes to work for free. That's something I learned."
"He won't come here. We'll have to go to San Francisco."
"Like it's still 1967.
What?
Reacher said, "Nothing."
10 minutes later, he was alone with Chang, in the room with the weaker Wi-Fi.
Chapter 44. They woke early the next morning, with open drapes and things on their minds, the same way they had the previous morning in Chicago, just 24 hours before. Reacher was revising his theory again, spellbound with the upward progression. It was beyond expectation, maybe beyond comprehension, whereas Chang was preoccupied with getting out of town. She was watching morning television on a local Phoenix affiliate, which had shoved recipes and fashion aside in favor of crime. One presenter was reporting on the fatal shooting of a suspected organized crime figure behind a downtown strip club, which involved much breathless speculation laid over meaningless pictures, mostly of the closed gate in the pink fence, above a ticker that said, "Moscow comes to Phoenix," which Reacher figured would annoy Ukrainians everywhere, the two countries being entirely separate now and proud of it, at least in one direction. The other presenter had the bigger story. No longer a home invasion turned tragic tonight, because tonight was now yesterday, and tragic was now inspiring. Apparently, a well-respected local doctor residing at the address in question had used a home defense weapon and killed 3 intruders,
thereby saving his family members from a fate worse than death. Evan Lair was seen on camera, in the far distance, at the limit of a shaky zoom, waving questions away. His reluctance to talk was seen as sturdy, old-fashioned modesty. His legend was building. He was halfway to becoming the badass doc, buoyed up by grainy nighttime videotape of gurneys coming out of the house, bathed in flashing red light. There were distant live shots of Emily, now out of the shirt and bikini, now in jeans and a sweater, and Lydia, who was looking down at the ground. Then a third presenter broke in to say she was hearing from the police department that the events might be linked, in that the three dead men from the house were known associates of the dead man at the strip club. And a fourth presenter broke in to say she had early word from the DA's office that the shootings at the house would likely be seen as justified, and that as far as the strip club incident was concerned, the murder weapon had been recovered from a nearby garbage receptacle, but there were no fingerprints on it, and therefore there were no suspects at this time, and the inquiry would continue. Up next, 10 things to do with chicken. Chang said,
"You okay?"
Reacher said, "Top of the world, except my head still hurts."
No reaction.
To what? She pointed at the screen.
All that?
My ears are still ringing a bit.
That's not what I mean.
I leave people alone if they leave me alone. Their risk, not mine.
You're not upset.
Are you?
What was the machine you saw at the farm at midnight?
It was a dot in the distance. It had a light bar, like a bull bar, but above the cab. 4 rectangular lights, very bright. Could have been a jacked-up pickup truck. More likely a tractor. It was working hard. I could see exhaust smoke in the lights.
Could it have been a backhoe?
Why?
That was the day Kiever disappeared.
Reacher said, "It could have been a backhoe."
That's why I'm not upset. It could have been me if things had been different. Suppose Michael had gone missing in Seattle. McCann would have called me, and then later I might have called Kiever for backup. Right now you could be hanging out with him, looking for me.
Perish the thought.
Could have happened.
You would have handled it better.
Kiever was a smart guy.
Was?
I guess I have to face it.
Smart, but not smart enough. He made a mistake. You might have avoided it.
What mistake?
Maybe the same mistake I'm about to make. He underestimated them. If they buried him on the farm with the backhoe, then Marchenko wasn't involved. Not at that stage. That was all their own work, no help required. Maybe they're better than we think.
They didn't look it.
Hope for the best, plan for the worst. That morning, 8 men met at the counter inside the Mother's Rest dry goods store. As before, the store owner was already there, still in 2 shirts, still unkempt and unshaven. As before, the first in to join him was the spare parts guy from the irrigation store, and then came the Cadillac driver from the FedEx store, and the one-eyed clerk from the motel, and the hog farmer and the counterman from the diner, and the Moynihan who had gotten kicked in the balls and had his gun taken. The 8th man arrived 5 minutes later, with his ironed jeans and his blow-dried hair. The first 7 guys said nothing. They waited for him to speak. He said, "The news is not good. Our faith was misplaced. The menu system did not function as expected. It did not do the job for us. As of now, we're on our own. some shuffling from the first seven. Not yet worry, but indignation, as in, it was all his own idea when it was looking good. Now it's we, and us, and ours. The hog farmer said, "Is that what I saw on CNN this morning? From Phoenix? The Russian guy?" "He was Ukrainian, and it wasn't just him. The other three were his, too." "What about the first one? Was his name Hackett?" "He's in the hospital in Chicago, with a cop at the door." "So none of them got the job done?"
"I told you that."
"Going outside of us was a big step. It cost us nothing, except money. They're still out there, but they always were out there. They left, and now they're coming back. We'll deal with them here."
"They'll bring the cops."
"I don't think so. They put Hackett in the hospital. I know that for sure. It was probably them in Phoenix, too, which means they can't talk to the cops. Any police department in the country would arrest them immediately, as a precaution, until the smoke cleared. They'll come here alone." More shuffling from the first seven. The Cadillac driver asked,
"When will they come?"
The man with the jeans and the hair said, "Soon, I expect. But we all know the plan, and we all know it works. We'll see them coming. We'll be ready." Reacher and Chang joined Westwood downstairs for breakfast, and Westwood said he had called the guy in Palo Alto and set something up for happy hour in Menlo Park, although he expected the guy to be late. He was that kind of guy. Then he had booked flights from Sky Harbor to SFO. 3 seats in business class, all that remained, and a hotel. 2 rooms only, which helped. His department's budget was cut every year. Reacher thought he had the nervous air of a gambler, deep in the hole but about to win big. When it was time, they took a cab to the airport, where their fancy tickets got them in a lounge, where Reacher ate breakfast again, because it was free. They boarded the plane at the head of the line and got a drink before taxi and takeoff. Better than the rows in back, even the exit rows. The flight itself was neither long nor short, but somewhere in between. Not a hop or a skip, but not a major portion of the Earth's circumference either. Less than New York to Chicago. The cab ride was easy, because it was basically out of town. Not that the Santa Clara Valley was sleepy anymore. It was the center of the world, all the way past Mountain View, and people drove like they knew it. The upcoming happy hour was in a bar near a bookstore in Menlo Park, and they found it at the second attempt. They were early, but not early enough to get to the hotel and back, so they paid off the cab and got out. The bar caused a moment of psychic concern, because every inch of it was painted red, and its name was Red, and the back of Reacher's brain spun through fantastical conceits, trying to work out how Westwood was either a cop or a bad guy, tormenting him with the ghost of pink, like something out of Shakespeare or Sherlock Holmes. But then he calmed down and figured the geek would have chosen the spot, and therefore the connection was coincidental, and not exact, anyway. The place was ironic, not tacky. The paint had a somber mid-century tone, like military issue. There were dirty, white-stenciled hammers and sickles, distressed and abraded to make them look old, and framed headlines from Pravda and Red Army helmets all battered and scratched. The sign at the door was written with a backward R to make it look Russian, which caused a minor echo of panic. Was it a reference to Machenko? No. Surely Westwood knew the difference between Russia and Ukraine. But were there Ukrainian-themed bars for a pedantic tormentor? Or would he have to settle for Russian anyway?
No, the geek chose it.
Chang said, "You okay?" Reacher said,
"Thinking too hard. Bad habit. Bad is not thinking at all."
"Let's wait in the bookstore."
Reacher tripped at the curb. Just a stumble. He didn't go down. More of a scuff than a trip. As if there was a lump or an uneven surface. He looked back.
"Maybe. Maybe not."
Chang said,
"You okay?"
He said,
"I'm fine."
Westwood said he had been in the bookstore before, a signing for an anthology he was in, science journalism, an award-winning piece. The store was a cool place in every way, from its refrigerated temperature to its customers. Westwood wandered one way and Chang another. Reacher looked at the books on the tables. He read when he could, mostly through the vast National Library of lost and forgotten volumes. Battered paperbacks, mostly, all curled and furry, found in waiting rooms, or on buses, or on the porches of out-of-the-way motels, read and enjoyed and left somewhere else for the next guy. He liked fiction better than fact, because fact often wasn't. Like most people, he knew a couple of things for sure, up close and eyeballed, and when he saw them in books, they were wrong. So he liked made-up stories better, because everyone knew where they were from the get-go. He wasn't strict about genre. Either shit happened or it didn't. Chang came back, and then Westwood, and they wandered back to the bar and got ready to wait. Being early gave them a choice of tables, and they took a four-top near a window. Reacher got coffee, and the others got sodas. Westwood said,
"This won't be good news, I'm afraid, even if the guy bites. The deep web is not an attractive place overall, so they tell me. Not that I spend time there myself, but you might not like what you see."
Reacher said, "It's a free country. And Michael was McCann's son, not mine. I don't care what he was into."
A clock on the wall ticked up to a Cyrillic 12, the top of the hour, and vodka went down in price by half. Happy hour. The first new person through the door was a young woman in her 20s, flushed, unmistakably new at something, but good at it. The second person through the door was the guy from Palo Alto, dead on time, not late at all. He was small, white as a sheet, thin as a specter, always moving, even when he was still. The 29-year-old veteran. He was dressed all in black. He saw Westwood and headed over. He nodded three ways and sat down. He said,
"The Valley likes irony. But you got to agree, happy hour in a Soviet shrine is the ultimate contradiction in terms. And speaking of the former USSR, my blog alerts tell me a Ukrainian named Merchenko was a mob hit last night, which is a happy coincidence. But he will be replaced. The market will fill the void. So I'm still not going public."
Westwood said,
"Neither are we. Not until long afterward in the newspaper, by which time there will be so much to bury you won't even be close to the top of the list. You have my word. You won't be public. All we need is to search, in private, for a missing individual and his possible destination."
"Search where?"
"Chat rooms, mostly. Maybe commercial websites."
"I don't want to become a public resource."
"I'm happy not to pay you."
"Then I would be doing it for friendship,
which makes the obligation worse. Reacher said, "Can you do it? If you wanted to?" The guy said, "I've been doing it since it was called the Undernet and the Invisible Web. It got harder, but I got better." The destination might be hard to crack. Cracking is easy. It's finding that's hard.
So what would get you to give us an hour of your time, apart from getting paid?
Do you have a motive, apart from getting paid? Does anyone, really?
As a matter of fact, I'm not getting paid.
Then why are you doing it?
Because some guy thinks he's pretty damn smart.
But you're smarter, and you have to prove it?
I don't have to prove it. I want to prove it, now and then, out of respect. For the people who really are smart, standards should mean something.
You're trying to steer me to the same conclusion. A battle of egos, me against them as coders. Good try. You know me well, even though we've only just met. But I've gone beyond. I'm happy there. I'm better than them. I know that. I'm secure in that knowledge. I no longer feel the desire to show it. Not even now and then. Not even out of respect. Not that I don't respect the way you feel. The old me would have agreed with you.
What would the new me agree with?
Tell me about the missing individual. Is he interesting?
35-year-old male, crippled by what the doctors call anhedonia, and his aunt calls his happiness meter stuck on zero. Otherwise normal IQ, functional some of the time.
Lived alone?
Reacher nodded. In sheltered housing.
Disappeared?
Yes.
Sudden new friend prior to disappearance?
Yes. The guy said,
32 seconds.
For what?
I'll find him in the deep web inside 32 seconds. I know where to look.
When can you do it?
Tell me about the aunt.
She married up, a doctor. She has a beautiful daughter, but she still loves her nephew and seems to understand him.
I like her image of the happiness meter.
We agreed mine is 4 to 9.
I've gone beyond. I hit 10 now. All the time.
That's the Molly talking.
The what?
I read it in the paper.
I haven't taken Molly for 2 years.
Something else now?
Everything else now. Got some stress.
Just remember, speed kills. That's what they told us back in the day.
I won't go public. You understand what that means?
Reacher nodded. There won't be a trial.
Was it you with Machenko?
Admit nothing, even on your deathbed. You might suddenly get better.
One night only,
the guy said.
No coming back to check on things. I need space of my own.
When can you do it?
Now, if you like.
Where?
At my house. You're all invited.
Chapter 45. The guy from Palo Alto had a thing on his phone that summoned cars to the curb within minutes. Riding forward to a car was deemed unseemly, so he pressed twice and got two. He rode with Westwood to catch up on old times, and Reacher and Chang followed in a town car all their own. The guy's house was a 1950s box, remodeled in the 1970s to look like the 1930s. Reacher figured it had a triple layer of ironic authenticity all its own, and was therefore
worth more than all the money he had made in his life. Inside it was clean, and all silver and black. Reacher had been expecting a tangled riot of computer gear, like they had seen in McCann's apartment in Chicago. But in the den there was nothing but a small glass table and a lone, no-brand desktop. There was a tower unit, and a screen, and a keyboard, and a trackball, none of which matched. There were only 5 wires, all cut to the right length, none tangled, all neatly placed. The guy said,
"I built it myself. There are various technical hurdles and some serious data incompatibilities to overcome. It's like visiting a foreign country. You have to learn their language and their customs, more importantly. I wrote some browser software based on Tor, which is what they all use, which was written by the United States Naval Research Laboratory, ironically, to provide a safe haven for political dissidents and whistleblowers all around the world, which is the law of unintended consequences right there, biting the world in the ass. Tor stands for the Onion Router, because that's what we're dealing with here. Layers upon layers upon layers, like the layers of an onion, in the deep web itself, and inside all of its separate sites." He sat down and fired up his machine. There was no fancy stuff on the screen, no pictures of outer space, no icons, just short lines of green writing on a black field. All business, like an airline check-in desk or a car rental counter. The guy said, "What's the missing individual's name?" Chang said,
"Michael McCann."
"Social security number?"
Don't know.
"Home address?"
Don't know.
"Not good," the guy said. "There are preliminary steps to be taken. I need what I call his internet fingerprint. It's an algorithm I wrote. Some of this, some of that. The precise minimum required to be definitive. Elegant, really. We can start with something as simple as his cable bill. But there are other ways." "Do we know his next of kin?"
"That would be his father, Peter McCann. His mother is long dead."
"Do we have an address for Peter McCann?" Chang told him. The undistinguished brownstone on the undistinguished street, Lincoln Park, Chicago, apartment 32. The guy typed a command, and what looked like a portal appeared into the Social Security Administration's mainframe. The real government deal.
Reacher glanced at Chang, and she nodded, as if to say, "It's okay, I have one too." The guy entered Peter McCann's data and found his Social Security number instantly, which instantly led to Michael's, because they were nominated for each other's survivor benefits. Next of kin. Michael's Social Security number led to his address, which was also in Lincoln Park, Chicago. Then the guy came out of Social Security and went into some other complex database. He entered Michael McCann's Social Security number and his address, and the screen redrew into a long list of alphanumeric codes. The internet fingerprint. Michael McCann, and no one else. The guy typed a new command, and the screen came up with a title page, crudely formatted out of plain green writing on a black background, but with tabs and spaces and centering, so that it looked vaguely like a commercial product, or a prototype, which it was, Reacher supposed, in a way, potentially. It looked inviting enough, like bright emeralds on velvet. The most prominent word on the page was bathyscaphe. "Get it?" the guy said.
"A submarine," Chang said, "capable of going all the way to the ocean bed."
"Originally, I called it Nemo,
after the guy in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. He commands a submarine named Nautilus. I liked him because Nemo is Latin for nobody, which seemed appropriate. But then they made a movie about a fish, which ruined it. He typed another command, and a search box came up. He said, "Okay, start your engines. 32 seconds is the wager." He pasted a whole lot of stuff into the search box. Not Michael McCann's name, but some of the long alphanumeric codes from the previous database, the fingerprint. Better than a name, presumably. The guy clicked the go tab, and the clock started running in Reacher's head. 5 seconds. The guy said, "One day it will be much faster. The raw search is good, but the page search is piped out to the find and replace function from an old word processor." 12 seconds. The guy said, "But please don't get the wrong impression. In absolute terms, it's fast enough. But the deep web is very big. That's the issue. And I don't have Google's advantages. No one is clamoring for my attention. They want the opposite. But I'm down there. Right now, I'm among them. They can't see me, but I can see them." 25 seconds. The guy said nothing. Then the search stopped. The screen changed to a list of links. "We found him," the guy said. 26 seconds. Well below the promised 32. "Pretty good," Reacher said. "I gambled. I narrowed the field. I knew where I might find him."
"Which was where?"
"I hope Mr. Westwood explained about me. The rabbit holes we go down are sometimes chosen for us, not necessarily on merit."
Reacher said, "The solving, not the problem."
"Searching the deep web is technically elegant, but being in it can be unpleasant. It has a bit of everything, but ultimately, it's a three-legged stool. A third of it is a vast criminal marketplace where everything is for sale, from your credit card number to murder. There are auction sites where hitmen compete for jobs. Lowest bid wins. There are sites where you can specify how your wife should die, and there are contractors who will give you a custom quote." Chang asked, "Where did you find Michael McCann?" The guy said, "The second leg of the deep web stool is pornography of the nastiest sort. Stomach-turning, even for me, and I'm not exactly a mainstream person."
"Is that what he was into?"
"No. I found him in the third leg."
"Which is what?"
"It was an easy guess. Because of the anhedonia? Because of the happiness meters stuck on zero? The third leg of the deep web is suicide."
The guy from Palo Alto said,
"I browse those boards from time to time. As an anthropologist, I hope. Not a voyeur. Not a spectator at the zoo. I imagine Michael McCann was on the low end of typical. Born depressed. And if his mother is long dead, she died when he was young. Not a good combination. I'm sure he wanted it all to end. Every day. We can't imagine how sure and certain these people are. These are not temporary ups and downs. These people hate their lives. Deeply and sincerely, and they want them to stop. They want to catch the bus. That's the phrase they use. They want to catch the bus out of town. But it's a big step. Some of the boards are about support, which is why I asked about the sudden new friend. They call them suicide partners. They do it together. They hold hands and jump, so to speak. The boards hook them up. There's a lot of discussion about compatibility. Is Michael's partner missing, too?" Chang said, "We don't know. We don't even know if it was a man or a woman. Near Tulsa, Oklahoma, we think."
Westwood said,
What do they talk about on the other boards?
They talk about how?
Endlessly. That's their big question. There's plenty of data out there. They discuss it like scripture. Best of all is a shotgun to the head. Instantaneous, as far as we know, and 99% effective. A handgun in the mouth is 97%. Shotgun to the chest, 96%, and a handgun to the chest, about 89%, which is about the same as hanging yourself. Setting yourself on fire scores about 76%. Setting fire to your house is about 73%. No one really wants to go lower than that. Meanwhile, jumping in front of a train is back up there at 96%, and jumping off the roof is at 93%, and driving into a bridge support is about 78%. But make sure you wear your seatbelt. You can get thrown clear. Unrestrained drivers score about 70 straight. You have to be there when the engine comes in through the dashboard.
And last but not least, ever popular, right back at the top, second only to the shotgun, is cyanide.
Better than 97% effective in about 2 minutes. But it's 2 minutes of hideous agony, and that's the problem right there. All the best ways are violent. Some folks can't handle that, men as well as women, and some don't have the circumstances. If you live in the city, you don't have your uncle's old varmint gun in the back of the barn. If you can't drag yourself to the bathroom, how can you drag yourself to the railroad track?
So what do?
They talk endlessly about the Holy Grail, swift and painless, like falling asleep and never waking up. That's what they're looking for. They had it once, or their parents did, a bottle of sleeping pills and a glass of scotch, or a hose pipe through the window of the family Buick. You fall asleep and you never wake up, guaranteed. But not anymore. Now the family Buick has a catalytic converter. No more carbon monoxide. Not enough, anyway. You get a headache and a rash. Your scotch is the same as ever, but your sleeping pills aren't. They're safe now. Take them all at once, and you'll sleep a day and a half, but you won't wake up dead. Life has gotten very protected in America, which gives these folks a problem. It's what drove them to the deep web in the first place. The stigma, of course, but mostly because the solutions to their problems started to look like gray areas. In the surface world, there would have been liability issues and social responsibility and all the rest of that lawyer stuff. As in, now your Buick is no good anymore. The new preferred source of carbon monoxide is the little hibachi grills you buy at the supermarket. A foil pan with charcoal and a metal grill, all shrink-wrapped and ready to go. You get 6 or 8 in your bedroom, and you put them high on shelves and you light them all up, and the monoxide pours out like liquid, heavier than air, and it pools on your bedroom floor and the level rises up to the bed and it snuffs you out, swift and painless, like falling asleep and never waking up. The Holy Grail. Except also, one of the grills probably sets the wall on fire and the building burns down, and whoever suggested the method gets hit by 500 lawsuits.
Chang said,
"What other laws are they breaking?"
It comes back to what they can handle. Even the hose pipe through the window was too rough for some. It's cold in the garage, and it's uncomfortable in the car, and the whole thing looks weird. Although carbon monoxide leaves a good-looking corpse, cherry red, looks healthy, makes the mortician's job very easy. But some folks want to die at home, inside the house. The Holy Grail is in bed. So the next new thing was gas of a different kind, plus an interesting medical fact. May I ask you a question?
If you have to hold your breath too long, what is it that makes you desperate to breathe again?
I'm running out of oxygen, I guess.
That's the interesting fact. It isn't the absence of oxygen. It's the presence of carbon dioxide. Kind of the same thing, but not exactly. The point is, you could suck up any kind of gas, and as long as it wasn't carbon dioxide, your brain would be happy. You could have a chest full of nitrogen, no oxygen at all, about to kill you stone dead, and your lungs would say, "Hey, man, we're cool. No carbon dioxide here. No need for us to start pumping again until we see some." Which they never will, because you'll never breathe again. Because you'll never need to. Because you have no carbon dioxide. And so on. So those folks started sniffing nitrogen. But you have to go to the welding shop, and the cylinders are too heavy to lift. So then they tried helium from the balloon store. But you needed masks and tubes, and the whole thing still looks weird. So in the end, most folks won't be satisfied with anything less than the old-fashioned bottle of pills and the glass of scotch. Exactly like it used to be. Except it can't be anymore. Those pills were most likely either Nembutal or Seconal, and both of those substances are tightly controlled now. There's no way to get them. Except illegally, of course, way down where no one can see you. There are sources. The Holy Grail. Most of the offers are scams, naturally. Powdered Nembutal from China, and so on. Dissolve in water or fruit juice. Maybe $800 or $900 for a lethal dose. Some poor desperate soul takes the cash to MoneyGram and sends it off, and then waits at home, anxious and tormented, and never sees any powdered Nembutal from China because there never was any. The powder in the online photograph was talc, and the prescription bottle was for something else entirely, which I felt was a new low in the end. They're preying on the last hopes of suicidal people.
Reacher said, "But you imply there are honest offers, too." You said, "Most, not all."
Seconal has gone completely. Nembutal is the last chance. Now the Holy Grail all by itself. The only legal use for Nembutal in the United States is large animal euthanasia. Some get stolen, and some veterinarians are bent. Why not? A lethal dose for a human would be 2 small bottles. Easy to ship. FedEx would take care of it. $900 for what gets splashed on the floor when you're killing a mule. You'll take that deal. He saw houses still lived in, and houses converted to offices for seed merchants and fertilizer dealers, and a large animal veterinarian.
Reacher said, "Show us exactly where Michael McCann was posting. We want to read what he said."